You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You know, it's difficult for me at this point, I guess, to muster any kind of novel emotion about Waitangi Day. We seem to see the same thing happen with slightly different faces every year. I want to say that it's been, you know, I think this year in particular is a really important year. We've just come off the back of a state-sponsored nationwide celebration and commemoration of the inception of colonialism, that being the Tuia 250. And they got a mention from the Prime Minister in her speech yesterday at Waitangi, but I think what it, the very important point, political point, that it missed is that of imperialism and the role of the Crown in maintaining imperialism in our country. And so, you know, I think it's really telling what they don't talk about as well as what they do talk about. So there's still no discussion around constitutional reform, and it's 4 years now since the 2016 Matike Mai Aotearoa report was released, and that report gave the year 2021 for a national forum to start to talk about what a tiriti-based constitution might look like for Aotearoa. The government has still not responded to it. The government has also refused to acknowledge or to repudiate the doctrine of discovery, and so I think all of those things are really telling about just how far the government will go in honouring te tiriti, and whether or not ultimately the what it is that they are doing it amount to distraction from the ultimate question of Māori sovereignty, of tino rangatiratanga. So this is an important year for us to prepare for our conversations around a tiriti-centred constitution, because those conversations will happen regardless. It's an election year, of course, and so I would hope that this is the election. I've been waiting for it for the last few, that we actually do see some discussions around constitutional reform from those who are campaigning as well. It hasn't been an election issue yet, so I would hope that it is one this year. But certainly for me, you know, until we're going to really sink our teeth into those difficult questions, the government is still failing to truly honour te tiriti, and is still clinging to this fraudulent notion that the treaty, the document that was forged by the British, is in any way relevant.
That it goes right to the heart of it, doesn't it? So you're talking this sort of fundamental, well, many things in terms of the government's unwillingness to even go there, even engage in this conversation, let alone actually, like you say, repudiate the doctrine of discovery. So, you know, I had on my mind in terms of what the discussions will be at Waitangi this year in terms of issues recently raised by Māori around whānau ora, oranga tamariki, housing, poverty, health, all of these things which are just day-to-day issues that remain day-to-day issues and have been for a very long time. But you're sort of pointing out that actually that all comes under this fundamental inability of acknowledging that the mana, I suppose, of te tiriti o Waitangi in terms of the Māori document, but also, even before that, any sort of sovereignty of Māori.
That's right, which is recognised through he whakaputanga as well, but you know, and it's important that all of those issues keep getting raised in front of the government to hold them to account for their failure. But you're quite right, all of those things are symptomatic of a decision-making structure that was, from its very inception, intended to dispossess Māori. The government was put in place as a model of indigenous dispossession, like most colonial governments are, and it has stayed true to that format over time, and it still is staying true to that format over time. And I think the fact that they have been called upon by the iwi chairs for them. They've been called upon by the Māori Council. They've been called upon by the Kia Mau movement to repudiate the doctrine of discovery, but they won't. And that's an easy win. Repudiate it. It's an easy one, but they won't. And so that says something also about exactly, you know, how much investment they had in really healing colonial injustice in 2019 through Tuia 250 as well. It would have been an easy and significant step for them to have repudiated it, as has been recommended by the United Nations and as has been, you know, signed up to by the New Zealand government through the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. They've signed up to a document that says that it's racist and scientifically false and should be repudiated, but they will not say those words here. And so those things are very telling, and until they do approach that, we're going to keep on going back to Waitangi. We're going to keep on having these debates. We're going to keep on holding them to account, but ultimately what we would like to see is that we have less things to hold them to account for, because we're the ones that are making the decisions. We have our sovereignty over our spaces, and that's why I call it kind of whack-a-mole politics. Rather than changing the nature of what it is that they're doing, they will try and deal with the many offshoots of the problems that are caused by that decision-making structure.
What would it actually mean? What does it mean, or what would it look like to repudiate the doctrine of discovery?
Well, I think, you know, for one of the issues inherent in the doctrine of discovery is that it sets the scene for imperial entitlement. And so when you repudiate the doctrine of discovery, you acknowledge that, you know, as a government, your position there is there by virtue of imperial expansion. You acknowledge that it was an act of injustice. You make commitments to put that injustice right, and that the people who have the ultimate authority in rangatiratanga, in our case, over our lands, are the Indigenous peoples. And so, you know, that it really sets in place an important context for the discussions of forming a new government, of forming a new way of decision making, of putting right and injustice. So it's parentally, it's acknowledging the injustice of imperial expansion that put the government there in the first place, and committing to putting that injustice right.
And in terms of constitutional transformation, which I suppose is that kind of goal, I suppose, of that conversation, right, the end part of that, how do we make that, or how does that become an election issue this year?
Again, I think, you know, all of the issues that are consistently raised in relation to child theft, state abuse of our children, hyper-incarceration of our people, of our wāhine, of our tāne, of our rangatahi, you know, the disparities in health, the disparities in education, all of those issues flow from the issue of constitutional reformation. And so, you know, I think we just, as usual, we need to just keep on putting that in front of them. The report that was put out in 2016 did really, you know, a lot of the heavy lifting on behalf of the government. It was based upon 260-odd hui up and down the country. It even developed, you know, potential models for how we could truly govern this country in a way that recognises te tiriti o Waitangi. And all the government had to do was go away and read it and come back with a response and engage in the conversation. And they have yet to do that. And so I think, you know, by us consistently raising our voices with every issue, but always also bringing it back to the fact that this stems from the wrong people making the decisions, you know, for Māori.
With all of those issues that are constantly being raised, and one of those things that does continue to get talked about in terms of, like whether it be ownership, is often the kind of government way of having this conversation around water. Where is this sitting for you at the moment?
If you understand the significant lack of well-being for our waterways at the moment, and you look forward within a few generations, it's only going to get worse. Climate change, particularly in our region in Tairāwhiti, but in many regions in Aotearoa, is going to result in less rain, because we've stripped the land of our water cycle aspects, that being our native forests. And so without those water cycles, we're going to have less rain. We're also going to have hotter days. There's going to be less water in our streams, essentially, and in our rivers, and in our aquifers, and in our groundwater. And so we really need to be making decisions now around the protection of those sources. We need to make sure that the streams are going to continue to flow and have enough water in them to look after the life within those streams, the ecosystems that keep those streams healthy. And then that in turn is going to determine the well-being of our coastlines and the broader oceanic environments as well. So for me, what's on my mind right now is the protection and the well-being of those awa, much more than, the economic benefits that people derive from it. It's in such a very poor and sick state that we really need to be talking about its health. You know, when your grandmother or your child or anybody that your child is looking after is sick and potentially dying, you don't talk about how much money they could be making you, or whether or not they're paying enough board, or what job they should be doing. You're talking about their health. You put their health first, and that's really the discussion that we should be having, is what do our rivers need from us? What do our lakes need from us? And some of that ultimately is going to require people to make sacrifices. And the sacrifices that we don't talk about enough in Aotearoa are the sacrifices that will have to be made by our farming community, who lobby aggressively. And there are some who are doing great jobs, you know, that's great. But still, they have a disproportionate level of impact upon our waterways, and that needs to be discussed. And you know, I guess if we are going to talk about economics, the projections are that the sun is setting on a lot of these industries as well, and we need to be talking about how do we support those industries to transition into either other industries or more sustainable modes of practice. All of that, I think what needs to be centred in all of that is what do our rivers need from us, what do our streams need from us. And I think one of the reasons you had gotten in contact with me in the first place was because I had mentioned, you know, there seems to be a really strong focus on water bottling. And I think a big part of that is that it just seems so unjust that we can't just go and drink water out of a stream or out of the tap, that the state of our waters are so bad now that many people feel that to have clean water they need to purchase it in a bottle. And that's certainly a discussion to be had. But in terms of environmental impact, it doesn't sit by itself, you know, as the worst thing that's happening to our waterways. It takes about, as I said, 1.3 litres of water to make 1 litre of water. But it takes hundreds, and by some estimates up to 1,000 litres of water to make 1 litre of milk. And it takes 2 litres of water to make 1 litre of soft drink. And it takes 4 litres of water to make 1 litre of beer. And so all of these kinds of industries need to be discussed in the way in which we are engaging with our waterways economically, I guess, needs to be discussed with that core issue of what do the waterways need.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.